From the intersection of religion, government, and politics, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy. This week we're broadcasting from the Center for American Progress Studios in Washington, D.C., where it's hot. Hot in many different ways. June 21st marks the celebration of solstice in the Wicca and pagan traditions. Coming up on the 27th, Catholics will observe the Feast of Corpus Christi. And the 28th marks the beginning of Ramadan in the Muslim faith. Now, here's what's coming up on this week's State of Belief.
The president is promising to sign an executive order ending workplace discrimination by federal contractors based on sexual orientation. That would affect 14 million employees.
Keeping a promise from his first presidential campaign, the Obama administration announced that the president will soon sign an executive order requiring federal contractors to observe non-discrimination policies for LGBT employees. Interfaith Alliance was represented at the White House meeting discussing that executive order by Benny Witkowski, and he'll be with us on this week's show. I'll also talk about the implications of this action and the importance of resisting letting those implications be poisoned by overly broad religious exemptions with the Right Reverend Bishop Gene Robinson.
I think what it requires of Catholics is a loyalty to the church prior to their political party. You know, we are Catholics before we're Democrats, we're Catholics before we're Republicans, we're even Catholics before we're Americans.
A lot of Americans who never thought that deeply about church teachings have had to learn to live with them, like it or not. From restrictions on reproductive health services to opposition to marriage equality and anti-bullying legislation, organized religion, primarily evangelical Protestant and Roman Catholic, has flexed its muscle in the church house and the state house. Fundamental to its influence is the church's insistence on immutable, God-endorsed truth, truth that only its leaders have access to. Which is why, when a closer look at history reveals that the truth is far less immutable and often far more arbitrary, political, and even sometimes accidental, it's vitally important to know that history. Even if it's not your faith tradition that's being looked at, because the public policy that results has an impact on every one of us. Later on this week's show, I'll be talking with Patricia Miller, author of the new book, Good Catholics, The Battle Over Abortion in the Catholic Church. But first,
God hates you. And I mean that in the kindest way.
This nation's under the wrath of God Almighty, and this nation needs to be told that.
Last week, we aired the first part of my wide-ranging interview with Nate Phelps, who grew up inside the notorious Westboro Baptist Church. At the age of 18, Nate Phelps left the congregation his father, Fred Phelps Sr., founded and was effectively cut off from most of his family. He struggled with faith for many years and today identifies as an atheist. Nate has become a widely respected writer and public speaker on issues of child abuse, particularly in a religious context, as well as LGBT rights. Hoping that his story of growing up in a world of violence and control may be helpful to others trapped in similar situations, Nate Phelps has agreed to do a documentary film of his life, Not My Father's Son, One Man's Journey from Hate to Hope. Right now, the filmmakers are urgently raising funds for the project already underway at the crowdsourcing website Kickstarter. The goal is $55,000, and the deadline for reaching that goal is July 7th. We'll put the link up on our website. I urge you to listen to part one of this conversation, available on our website at stateofbelief.com. But right now, here's part two of my interview with Nate Phelps. I know that you have this desire to work with victims of religious abuse. When you look back, was there anything that could have been done outside your family that would have helped you and your brothers and sisters?
What a great question. I honestly don't think there was. because you have to look at the time we were growing up. This was in the 60s and the 70s. We think that Christianity has a stronghold on America now. Go back to that period.
Yeah.
And that's part of the reason why my father was able to be that way for so long, is because he lived in an environment where that was accepted.
Yeah.
Even though at one point there was charges brought against him for child abuse, eventually those even were dropped because he was a preacher. He was a man of the cloth.
Yeah.
Folks just gave them more credit.
Yeah.
So, you know, and then you, what does that help look like if the state gets involved? Are they going to get involved taking 13 kids away?
Yeah.
Or are they going to turn their head? And is my mom able to take care of 13 kids on her own? That wasn't real life, so there wasn't anything that could be done.
Yeah. Do you still have relationships with family members who have left the Westboro Baptist Church?
I do. In fact, I worked for like 25 years with my older brother, Mark.
I see.
And my younger sister, who has left for good, is actually still living in Topeka, and her and I have a good relationship.
Do you see a pattern in members who have left, or were your experiences unique?
Well, the younger generation, I mean, Mark certainly had very similar experiences that I did, maybe not to the extent I did. And Dortha was, you know, she was one of the younger ones, so things seemed to have started, I guess he got tired at some point, so it wasn't so profound. But she has still has a lot of emotional harm because of the issue of women being second-class citizens
mm-hmm.
in that religious environment, right? That was a big part of growing up there, too. But the younger generation, they've got a different set of issues because they didn't experience the violence like we did.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of my nieces and nephews, you know, they still have the theology. They still have the belief that because they left there, they're going to spend eternity suffering for it.
Hmm. You obviously were the victim of a manipulation of religion to control or try to control your life. We're seeing a lot of manipulation of religion from some religious communities today, both in the political world and in the religious world. I'd just be interested in what comment you have on the manipulation of religion that you saw in your own life.
Well, I'm not sure how best to answer that question. When my family first started this campaign, and suddenly there were reporters wanting to talk to me about it, and there was stories out there, the general consensus was that this was a cult and these guys were not true Christians
mm-hmm.
and were brainwashed and all that kind of language that you hear. Mm-hmm. And I remember thinking when I first heard, that's just not true. This isn't like David Koresh or Jim Jones. This mm-hmm. This is what's in the Bible.
Yeah.
And perhaps because I was in the position I was in, I don't know, but I hold to the idea that my father was absolutely honest in what he was doing.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't change my mind for a moment that the effect was
mm-hmm.
manipulative and that the harm was profound and for a lifetime.
Yeah.
But I don't know about when we talk about manipulation, what's the road to hell is paved with good intentions,
yeah,
right? I think he had good intentions.
You're making a great point. You really are.
So I can't, when I look at what goes on out there with some of these politicians and some of the messages and programs that are out there as far as the moral majority or
right.
their predecessors,
right?
I don't know. It sure feels like manipulation to me as an adult looking at it, right?
Right. What is your understanding of what happened within the church during your father's illness and then since his passing?
As long as it's clear that I can only tell you what I heard, so this is definitely hearsay.
I understand.
I'll tell you that. I had a conversation, or actually I got a message from one of my nieces who said that one of Shirley's children had left like 2 weeks prior, and that he came out with the story that Fred had been in a battle with the Board of Elders, which, as I understand, there are eight mm-hmm. of the men now are the Board of Elders on that church,
mm-hmm.
that they voted him out.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I have heard that they voted him out because he was advocating for a kinder approach, and I have also heard that they voted him out because it was basically a power struggle.
Yeah.
I don't know. I know that they physically removed him from, because like I said, we grew up, we lived in that building. He lived in that church building for 55 years or longer.
Goodness.
And they moved him out of there, and they moved him into another house, and they had people watching him because they were afraid of his reaction.
Yeah.
And that he quit eating. He didn't want to go on living, apparently.
Yeah.
And that is what quickly led him to hospice care.
Well, Nate, I know that this discussion, certainly for anyone that pays attention, makes it even more important for the documentary that you're going to do that's called Now Not My Father's Son. You've started this Kickstarter campaign to fund the production of the documentary, and that ends on July the 7th. We want to tell our listeners how they could make a contribution to see that this campaign gets the funding it needs to see the documentary made. So will you say just a word or two about that and how people can send money to you for that purpose?
Yeah. The best way to do it is to, if you get on Google and just Google the words Kickstarter and Not My Father's Son, and it'll send you straight to that page. And then there's you have the opportunity to give a contribution. And along the right side of that webpage is a list of gifts that are given based on the amount of the contribution.
Yeah.
And we're also working on coming up with maybe a couple more options in that category as well. So there's a lot of nice stuff that people can get and still provide resources for us getting the filming done.
And you need about $55,000 in all.
Yep.
So we're going to also link to that page from our website. One last question.
Sure.
For someone who watches Not My Father's Son after it's made, what do you hope will be the result of someone seeing it?
The approach I've taken over the years is I believe that if you can reach people's hearts, but that's the first step in getting them to change their mind, especially on some of these tough, knotty issues that people hold on to dearly. And what I'm hoping will happen is that people will see the world of religion and the impact that religion has, not only on the individuals growing up in an extreme environment like that, but on the ideas that exist out there as a result of religion.
Yes.
That caused so much harm in other areas. Specifically, one of the areas I focus on is the LGBT community.
Sure. Well, Nate, I want you to know that I am a person who embraces religion and tries to practice it, and I could not be sorrier than I am right now in hearing the way in which you experienced religion and the terrible, terrible consequences of that in your life. Nate Phelps, my friends, was raised in the Westboro Baptist Church that was started by his late father, the Reverend Fred Phelps, Sr. The Kickstarter campaign is underway to make a documentary of his experience and of that experience in the church. Nate, I really appreciate your honesty, your candor, and I think that the interview itself will be of benefit to a lot of people because a lot of people have been hurt by religion, and thank you for talking about it.
Appreciate the opportunity, sir.
Patricia Miller has written extensively about the intersection of politics, sex, and religion, everything you're not supposed to talk about. Her work appears in Religion Dispatches and elsewhere, and when she was last on this show, we talked about the book that she was working on, Good Catholics, The Battle Over Abortion in the Catholic Church. Well, the book is now out, published by University of California Press, and if ever there was such a thing as an ethical, theological, historical page-turner, this is it. And I'm delighted that it brings Patricia Miller back to State of Belief Radio. Patty, welcome back.
Thank you so much, Welton. I'm delighted to be back.
What made you want to write this book?
Well, as someone who grew up in the Catholic Church in the 70s and 80s in a fairly normal, moderate parish in suburban New Jersey, I was just really struck by how much abortion discourse has come to dominate the life of the Catholic Church. That just wasn't the way it was 20 or 30 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
You could happily go to church for years and participate in parish activities and honestly never hear the word abortion mentioned. It was not the marker of what made a good Catholic. And it seems like nowadays that's become really the demarcation between what is a good Catholic and not a good Catholic, is someone adhering to a very strict anti-abortion position. I was curious as how that came to be.
The disconnect between how most people think doctrine is formed and how it sometimes is actually formed is nothing less than breathtaking. And then that doctrine makes its way into the secular world to radically influence public policy. It's a hard thing to summarize, I know, but I wish you would talk briefly about the way the development of the pill was handled by the Catholic Church.
It's a fascinating story, and I guess I would just preface it by saying it shouldn't surprise anyone that the development of Catholic doctrine, like so many other things, is at the end of the day fundamentally political. It often serves the needs of the people who are in power at the Vatican at that moment. There was a movement in the 60s to approve birth control. It was very consistent with Catholic doctrine. A very famous judge and author, Noonan, wrote a book called Contraception and really laid out all the reasons that Catholic doctrine did not say you couldn't use contraception. It was kind of a hodgepodge of myth and theology and folk beliefs and long-term old-school prohibitions against using contraception because there was an interest in growing the population back in the days when there weren't a lot of people around. And he said, you know, there's really no reason we can't change that. A lot of theologians believed that the doctrine could be changed, that it was really based on a very outmoded idea of marriage, which was that marriage was primarily for procreation, and that in the modern world, the church had already recognized that marriage was both for procreation and also for companionship and for the completion of the person within the relationship of marriage. And so they said, you know, there's no reason we can't change this because we've already recognized when we said you could use natural family planning, which is the rhythm method, that Catholics could limit their family size. So why not just change the doctrine? It was really just changing the method that was allowable, not whether family planning itself was allowable. Perfectly logical approach to evolving a doctrine. It was really an evolution of a doctrine. The reason that didn't happen was political. There was a small faction within the church that felt very strongly that the church's authority on these issues was tied to not being seen as wrong on the issue ever. And there was really a underlying belief that to give women the right to decide when and if they got pregnant was really going to change the way the church viewed women. They viewed women still as primarily a mother and defined by their biological function. And when they really looked at what that change in contraception doctrine would mean to that idea of women, they backed down and they did not change it. It was a very political decision at the end of the day.
And where did the pressure come from for the decision going the way it did?
The belief is that there was a small group of thinkers within the Vatican, about four bishops who famously wrote a minority report to the mainstream report. Interestingly enough, the Pope's own commission on birth control said the doctrine should be changed. It was a minority report written by four dissenting theologian priests that really held sway over a much larger group of both bishops and lay people who did decide the doctrine should be changed.
So it didn't just come down from heaven.
It did not come down from heaven. It came from actual humans.
There's an amazing quotation that you attribute to a theologian of the period who asked what would happen to the millions we've sent to hell for using contraception if the teaching were suddenly changed. Now, was that theology or was that politics?
That was politics, and I think that was human pride. It was the sense that if we admitted we were wrong, we would look foolish. And so, therefore, we must hold on to a incorrect belief in the face of all the overwhelming evidence that it is fact incorrect. And you can see a lot of what's happened in the Catholic Church ever since then has been trying to cover that up and explain that and paper that over. And that's why there's, I think, so much instability in the church doctrine around all the sexuality-related issues, because that doctrine was so fundamentally flawed.
Patty, I don't mean to sound cynical here, because I have appreciation for the Catholic Church, but I've read the formative theologians of the Catholic Church, the ancient ones, and when you read Augustine and Aquinas and those people, I have to say they were so screwed up on sexuality that they couldn't have done anything else but put the church in a confused situation.
That's very true. And they were even more screwed up, unfortunately, on women, because they saw women as really a lesser version of men. As I think it was Augustine who called women a misbegotten creature. They saw women as kind of poorly formed men, as half-formed men. So anything that had to do with woman and sex is just kind of polluted from the get-go by that understanding. And that's exactly what the modern theologians were trying to look at when they suggested revising the birth control doctrine, because they said our understanding of woman has evolved. So let's look at that doctrine in light of how we view woman nowadays. And when that didn't happen, it unfortunately kept a lot of those historical undertones about women and sex in the Catholic doctrine that should have been excavated right about 1968.
When you look at the endless lawsuits over the contraception coverage mandate today, how much difference you think it would make if this history was more widely known?
People would have laughed the bishops and their allies right out of the courts when they came forward with these lawsuits. Because not only do most Catholics use contraception, but the doctrine is so theologically unsound and was so close to being changed that I really think they would have no viability on this issue if this was better known.
What about abortion in church history?
Abortion, too, has a very interesting history where it was viewed at different times in different ways. The church has always taught that abortion is a sin. But the Catholic Church did not teach until very recently that abortion was murder. Much like society in general, the Catholic Church recognized that the human fetus gains value as the pregnancy progresses. Early abortion was not considered murder. Much as in common law in this country and in other countries, abortion before a fetus had what they used to call quickened, which was about the fourth or fifth month when the woman could feel the fetus moving. That was not considered murder. That was considered before the fetus was a definable human being separate from the mother, and that was treated separately than murder. It was considered serious and in some cases a sin, but there was much more leeway for abortion than people think of in Catholic theology.
What were the battles that took place around that?
The biggest battle really has been this idea that this idea even existed. Pro-choice Catholics, pro-choice theologians, pro-choice priests and nuns, all of which there have been, have argued that this history of understanding Catholic theology on abortion needs to be better understood to have discussions about things, for instance, if abortion should be allowed in cases of rape or incest or fetal deformity, which there's widespread support for allowing abortion in those instances. So the fact that these discussions have even occurred in church history has been somewhat suppressed. The Catholics who have said either that you can talk about abortion or that if you are a Catholic in public life, if you are a Catholic politician and want to vote in ways that represent all your constituents, not just your Catholic constituents, since no one who is a politician in America just has Catholic constituents, that they're not allowed to do that. There's been huge battles over the issue of pro-choice Catholic politicians being able to represent the pro-choice point of view in their political life, even if they hold a view in their private life that is more close to Catholic doctrine.
Mm-hmm. When I grew up in the evangelical tradition, Catholics were only questionably Christian, and yet the evangelical churches have taken the hard-line Catholic doctrine and made that their doctrine.
I think it's a very fascinating development of the past, especially 20 years. We just recently hit the 20th anniversary of a very landmark declaration called Catholic and Evangelicals Together,
right,
where the evangelicals agreed to set aside their historic taste of Catholicism to team up with conservative Catholics on the life issues.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when you really begin to see this very hardcore Catholic doctrine about abortion, but increasingly about contraception also, which evangelicals historically never had really had objections to contraception one way or the other. They tended to be at least agnostic about the issue. One of my contentions of my book is this far-right Catholic distaste for contraception has really infected the Christian right in some ways as well.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you were already smart when you started writing this book, so I want to ask you, what surprised you the most while you were working on the book?
Really, what surprised me the most was the stories of the people that I encountered, especially the women who very bravely in the 60s came out publicly and said, I use birth control, I believe a good Catholic can have an abortion or can support abortion rights in public life. These women were some of the earliest Catholic theologians, women. They were very cutting edge for their era, and a lot of them didn't get a lot of public acclaim at the time. Many of them were unable to find careers in theology because they were women. But they waged a very lonely fight because they felt it was right that women should make their voice heard in the Catholic Church. I was surprised to learn how many women there were like that, say, in the 60s and 70s, and how little known they are nowadays because they were kind of successfully stifled in some ways by the church. But, of course, their ideas have really lived on in the pro-choice Catholic doctrine that exists today.
If you had your way, when a reader finishes reading that book, what do you want them to feel?
I would like them to feel that the Catholic history on sex and sexuality is much richer than most people realize, that the theology and the doctrine that has been kind of sold, especially in the past 20 years, it's kind of a thin gruel, and there's a much richer soup of thought and people and ideas. It is much more in line with the democratic tradition. Catholics have always taken great pride in, you know, many from immigrant populations coming to this country and participating in this democracy. And I think we've seen a real narrowing of those views, especially when it comes to abortion and contraception. And I think Catholics should be proud of the richness of that history and not ashamed to embrace that.
Mm. Patricia Miller is the author of the excellent new book, Good Catholics, The Battle Over Abortion in the Catholic Church. You can read an excerpt at Religion Dispatches, actually, and we'll link to that from our website. Patty also has a new column up at Huffington Post, headlined, Why the Catholic Church's Suppression of Abortion Dissent Should Concern Us All. It's well worth reading as well. Patricia Miller is a past editor of Conscience Magazine, the leading journal of pro-choice Catholic thought, and the editor-in-chief of National Journal's Daily Healthcare Briefings. Patty, great to have you on State of Belief Radio, and the conversation is enlightening and interesting, and I hope we can talk again soon.
I look forward to it, Welton. Thank you so much.
At a White House meeting on Monday of this past week, the Obama administration began briefing some people on his intent to sign an executive order requiring that all federal contractors doing more than $10,000 in business with the federal government have in place anti-discrimination protections for LGBT employees. Joining me right now to discuss this important development is the Right Reverend Gene Robinson, retired Episcopal Bishop of New Hampshire and a leading voice for inclusivity both within and beyond the church. Gene, it's a pleasure to talk with you about almost anything.
I am delighted to be here. I always am. Thank you, Will.
President Obama spoke this week to supporters about this executive order. Were you at that meeting?
No, but I did read the text of his speech last night, and it was really quite extraordinary. And I think even for LGBT people, to hear a sort of a recitation of the changes that we have seen in the term and a half of his presidency was just really quite astounding.
Yeah.
And anyone who thinks that who is president doesn't make a difference is just crazy.
That's, frankly, Gene, some people don't understand what an important step this is. Please talk about that.
We have a really mind-boggling situation developing, which is that we have marriage equality coming to certain states where there is no job protection for being gay.
Mm.
And so you get marriage equality, and if your boss reads about your wedding in the newspaper or hears about it, you can be fired the next day for being gay with no recourse to the courts whatsoever.
Mm.
So I think a lot of people have just thought, and in fact the surveys and polls show, that most people think that LGBT people are protected at work and in public accommodations.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact of the matter is those protections are not in place in 29 states.
Mm.
And so we have this very odd situation in which a gay couple can legally get married, but they can be fired for being gay, and there is just no recourse to the courts.
What are the biggest benefits, Gene, of this expansion?
So it's important to understand that what the president has done affects those who work for federal contractors. The best guess is that this could affect as many as a million gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender people.
Mm-hmm.
And to his great credit, he not only protected those on the grounds of sexual orientation, but also gender identity.
Mm-hmm.
And we know that in many of the states, while there is protection for being gay or lesbian, there is not the same protection for transgender people. So he is to be applauded for that. I think the real importance of this, beyond the actual protections that it will provide for LGBT people who work for government contractors, is exactly what we saw when the president came out in favor of marriage equality itself,
yeah,
which is that he is using the bully pulpit of the presidency to set a new tone and a new standard in the country. And this does that around job protections. There was no way to imagine really how important the president's advocacy for marriage equality would be. And I think also this will be a tremendous boost forward, because the Employment Non-Discrimination Act, which would do this for all LGBT Americans, has stalled in Congress. I think it's been sitting there for them to work on for close to 20 years now.
Yes.
And we just can't seem to get any action on it in the House. The Senate has passed the Employment Non-Discrimination Act, and there it sits with inaction by the Republican House.
Right.
And so I think once again, the president sort of sets the way. Now, just to let you in a little bit, we've been pushing the president on this. He's been promising this since the beginning of his presidency, and some people have wondered why it's taken so long, but it's a little like childbirth. You know, once the baby comes, you forget the pain of it. And so now that it's here, we're glad that it's here, and we're appreciative to the president for what he's done.
I was really impressed that he did identify transgendered people in this. As you know, the truth is that among proponents of non-discrimination legislation, there's always been a tension as to whether it's most important to get something passed first, even if it's limited and not all we want, or whether it's essential to demand that protections cover everyone right away. And he took that issue off the table and said transgender people will be involved.
Yes, he did. And there's almost no way to overstate the importance of that.
Right.
Our earliest version of the Employment Non-Discrimination Act did not include transgender people.
Mm-hmm.
And it caused a tremendous amount of hurt amongst people who are already extremely vulnerable. And I think what the LGBT community learned is that we have to bring everybody along, and we can't leave anybody behind. There are always these discussions around strategy, aren't there?
Yes.
You know, where we have to decide is incremental progress okay, or do we need to hold out for the full loaf?
Mm-hmm.
And I think one of the things that we've learned is that when you settle for only part of the loaf, people consider you fed, right? I mean, they think, oh my gosh, well, we've done all we need to do on this. And so doing the other incremental changes mm-hmm. turn out to be twice as hard if you've done just a part of them already.
Right.
And so I think he did us a great favor in as you say, taking this off
yeah.
the table.
One of the risks of taking this action at this particular time in history is that the forces demanding unprecedented so-called religious exemptions to non-discrimination policies are especially well-organized and well-funded right now. Do you have concerns about that religious exemption philosophy?
Yes, I do. And I think this is the new battlefront. I mean, even Maggie Gallagher, the former head of the so-called National Organization for Marriage, has basically said, look, we lost the marriage battle.
Mm-hmm.
Now the battle is moving to using so-called religious liberty arguments to be exempted from the anti-discrimination laws that are being written into the laws. And then this is something we have to be very, very attentive to because it has enormous ramifications. And of course, we're all waiting with bated breath for the Supreme Court to mm-hmm. rule on the case that was brought by Hobby Lobby and by Conestoga Wood Specialties, which was an Amish-owned company.
Mm-hmm.
And among the claims that are being made is that corporations can have freedom of religion, that corporations have the same right as individuals to freedom of religion, which is, you know, if it weren't sitting there before the Supreme Court, would be kind of a laughable thing. I mean,
mm-hmm.
where do corporations worship, and what do they worship besides the bottom line?
Yeah.
And how do they pray, and what do they pray for, and where is their soul that needs saving?
Yes.
It's just a bizarre twisting of an argument to try to allow people using their freedom of religion as a reason to avoid laws that pertain to everyone else. And if we open this Pandora's box, it is just going to be very, very difficult to stuff all the demons back inside.
You're absolutely right. And let me say, as somebody that has been a proponent of religious freedom for 50 years or more, real religious freedom is promised in the Constitution was never intended to impose discrimination.
Exactly.
Everything but that. And
and you know, I'm as liberal as they come, but I would fight to the death to protect a church, a synagogue, a mosque from having to perform a gay marriage, for instance, or to authorize or bless that in any way if that was against their beliefs.
Yeah.
I totally believe in this cherished and fought for freedom of religion that is just so important to our country. But I really do believe it's a devilish thing to take that and try to expand it and use it as an excuse to exempt oneself from anti-discrimination laws that are meant to protect all of us.
Absolutely.
And it's an even worse thing to do in the name of the church, in the name of God, when I can't imagine anything further from the will of God.
Gene, while I've got you, I also want to just take a second, and I'm running out of time, for a mention of the bill that Senator Edward Markey of Massachusetts introduced this month, the International Human Rights Defense Act. It has 24 co-sponsors already. It calls for the State Department to make anti-gay discrimination and violence a priority of foreign policy. I'm sure you have thoughts on that.
I do, and it's my fervent prayer that this will become more and more important to the American LGBT community. I think as we mature as a community, and as we have secured more and more of our equal rights, that we will begin to look beyond ourselves and understand that we have a role to play in the world. And of course, as you well know, a world that shrinks daily, right? I mean, with mm-hmm. with the internet, there's almost one world, one community anymore. And in that world, you know, we still have some 70 countries that criminalize LGBT people, and in some place it's punishable by death.
Yeah.
And it's time that we put our foreign policy and our moral leadership in the world behind this kind of equal rights for all people, but especially right now where we see gay and lesbian, bisexual and transgender people harassed and beaten and murdered and just treated in inhuman ways. And to put this firmly in the same basket with all the human rights that we believe are worth standing up for. And I'm doing increasingly a lot of work in this regard, and in fact, we'll be spending 10 days in El Salvador working with LGBT groups there, and the Episcopal Church there in El Salvador has just been doing incredibly courageous work in welcoming LGBT people into their congregations in a country that can be quite oppressive and violent. Right. So, yeah, I think this is sort of the opening salvo in a much broader and deeper discussion of what is our role going to be in the world in this part of the human rights movement.
The Right Reverend Gene Robinson is the retired Episcopal Bishop of New Hampshire and a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress. I thank you for making time for us and for being with us again today on State of Belief.
Well, it's always a special treat for me to be able to rejoice with you.
Now, before we go, Benny Witkowski is a young, essential part of our team at Interfaith Alliance. On Monday, we sent him over to the White House for the announcement of President Obama's plan to sign that executive order expanding workplace protections for LGBT Americans. I want us to have some sense of what that was like. And Benny, welcome to State of Belief Radio.
Thanks, Welton. What the president did on Monday is he instructed his staff to draft an executive order that would ban discriminating against the LGBT community by all federal contractors.
Is it all right to ask what organizations were in the room?
The meeting that I was at was along with Interfaith Alliance, the Anti-Defamation League, Americans United for the Separation of Church and State, the Religious Action Center of Reformed Judaism, and a number of other religious organizations and separation of church and state organizations.
That's not unusual. These are organizations that work in a coalition together. Others are present as well. I know I was supposed to go to that meeting, and we usually go into the executive office building. You got to go into the West Wing, as I understand, so I'm a little envious of that. But what was it like to be in that room talking about that issue, knowing that representatives of the president were in the room and wanting to hear what our voices were saying?
On a personal level, it was really remarkable and really amazing. And I think about how much different these meetings must have been during administrations that were less friendly to our cause. This was an instance where they knew what we were going to say, but they really care deeply about this issue. We talked a lot about the many advancements for LGBT rights that have happened under the Obama administration, and that this is just one in a long, long list.
Talk about some of the lobbying that Interfaith Alliance has done on this and some of the allies that we've been working with in that lobbying.
And it really fits well with this executive order because, as we said, they announced their intentions to sign the order, but we still don't know what it's going to look like. And there's some concern over if there will be a religious exemption for government contracting organizations that are religious organizations, will they have to follow this executive order? And a lot of the advocacy work that Interfaith Alliance does now has to do with that very idea of religious exemptions. We see it in the healthcare mandate that is being decided by the Supreme Court in the next couple of weeks. We see it in the Employment Non-Discrimination Act and a number of other pieces of legislation where certain forces are trying to carve out protections for religious communities, and in a lot of instances, they go way too far, Interfaith Alliance thinks, and is trying to hold by the true notion of religious freedom, which is that while you're entitled to your own religious practice, you're not entitled to force that religious identity and that religious ideology onto your employees, your customers, or other people that you might be around.
You know, and I know this is a promise that Barack Obama made, I think, during his first presidential campaign
It is.
Do you have a sense of what took so long?
This was not brought up in the meeting. I don't know exactly why it took so long, but we have heard conflicting reports from the administration as to whether or not they think that this executive order is a complement to the Employment Non-Discrimination Act, which is a much broader bill that would ban discrimination against LGBT people in the workplace in all workplaces, or whether or not this is something that would happen instead of that. Over the last 4 years, we've seen a lot of progress on the mm-hmm. Employment Non-Discrimination Act. And now it passed the Senate last October. It has, I think the last count was just about 200 co-sponsors in the House. So almost at 50% co-sponsorship in the House. It's really close to becoming a law. And I think that the president was worried about creating a backlash against that bill by signing this executive order. Mm. Now that that bill is stagnating in the House, and now that we might see a bad ruling on the Hobby Lobby case mm-hmm. that could really affect the nature of these policies, mm-hmm. I think that's why we're seeing the president act now.
Well, Benny Witkowski does important work on policy for Interfaith Alliance. On Monday, he represented us, the organization, at a White House briefing in which the issue was President Obama's intention to sign an executive order soon, expanding workplace anti-discrimination protections to cover LGBT workers employed by federal contractors. Benny, thanks for the work you do, not only on this particular issue, thanks for what you do with the Interfaith Alliance, and thanks also for being with us today on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you, Wilton, and thank you for letting me take your place at the White House on Monday.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. Your generous support is essential in helping to make this show possible. I hope you know that. Please visit stateofbelief.com and consider making a financial contribution today. We'll use it wisely to keep State of Belief on the air and to expand the reach of this program. Every week, we hear from listeners across the country who say they rely on our show for the kind of inclusive, respectful approach to interreligious dialogue they can't find anywhere else. Stateofbelief.com is where you'll find out more about the show. You can hear extended interviews, watch in-studio videos, read transcripts, and sign up for our podcasts. I hope you'll stay in touch with us throughout the week on Facebook and Twitter. The listener line, if you want to call that, is 202-681-4246. We encourage you to tell others about the show and encourage them to listen, too. The interviews this week are interviews you ought to be talking about with your friends. I bet they're interested, and think what a discussion you could have. Join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
The only one who could ever reach me was the son of a preacher man. Could ever teach me was the son of a preacher man. You see what he was. Yes, he was.